Many of you are probably familiar with a painting like this one that the projector is putting on the wall above my head. It depicts a man kneeling in the snow beside his horse, and he is probably praying. And the man is George Washington. This particular painting is by, I don't know who it's by. It's by a guy who painted it in 1975. But there are many other such paintings, and several painters have really been inspired by the story behind that painting and decided to depict it. There are several legends that have been circulating that form the basis for these paintings. And there are several legends. They're similar, although you can trace them back to certain specific sources. One source of a legend about George Washington kneeling in the snow in prayer was written by Nathaniel Randolph Snowden, Presbyterian, I believe. And he wrote about this in his journal. And in his journal, he tells about the time when his friend, a man named Isaac Potts, who was a Quaker, related this story to Snowden. This journal of Snowden is held by the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. I think they have the original copy. And I found this journal entry on the internet. I'm going to read to you what it says. But as you hear this, be just a little bit skeptical, because I'm telling you about something I read on the internet, about something that was in a journal in the Historical Society of Pennsylvania that was written by a man who heard his friend tell him about something that he saw somebody else do. So this is far from a primary source about the spiritual life of George Washington. Here is the story by Mr. Snowden. I knew personally the celebrated Quaker Potts. This man was a Quaker. Quaker was not his first name. I personally knew the celebrated Quaker Potts, who saw General Washington alone in the woods at prayer. I got it from himself myself. Weems mentioned it in his History of Washington, but I got it from the man myself as follows. I was riding with him, Mr. Potts, in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, near to the Valley Forge, where the army lay during the War of the Revolution. Mr. Potts was a senator in our state and a Whig. I told him I was agreeably surprised to find him a friend to his country, as the Quakers were mostly Tories. He said it was so, and I was a rank Tory once, for I never believed that America could proceed against Great Britain, whose fleets and armies covered the land and ocean. But something very extraordinary converted me to the good faith. What was that? I inquired. Do you see the woods and that plain? It was about a quarter of a mile off from the place where we were riding, as it happened. There, he said, lay the Army of Washington. It was a most distressing time in the war, and all were for giving up the ship, but that great and good man. In that woods, pointing to it close in view, I heard a plaintive sound as of a man at prayer. I tied my horse to a sapling and went quietly into the woods, and to my astonishment, I saw the great George Washington on his knees alone, with his sword on one side and his cocked hat on the other. He was at prayer to the God of the armies, beseeching to interpose with his divine aid, as it was the crisis and the cause of the country, of humanity, and of the world. Such a prayer I never heard from the lips of a man. I left him alone praying. I went home and told my wife. I saw a sight and heard today what I never saw or heard before, and just related to her what I had seen and heard and observed. We never thought a man could be a soldier and a Christian, but if there is one in the world, it is Washington. She also was astonished. We thought it was the cause of God and America could prevail. He then to me put out his right hand and said, I turned right around and became a Whig. Now that is an interesting story, but there are several reasons to believe that it is untrue. One website points out, and I think they're right, that Snowden, the man who wrote this journal entry, possessed the correct facts, but he neglected their importance at the moment of his journal writing. The Valley Forge National Historical Park, which is located in eastern Pennsylvania, They were given a grant to put a statue of this scene of Washington kneeling in prayer at the entrance to the park. But the park authorities refused, stating that there was ample evidence to suggest that the Washington prayer story was a hoax. And according to one blogger that I found, perhaps the most damning piece of evidence against the Valley Forge painting is the simple fact that George Washington refused to pray on his knees. Historians and biographers of Washington have pointed out the fact that Washington would choose to stand instead of kneel when praying. In fact, Washington made it clear to his military advisors that he detested anything that brought a man to his knees. And I believe that the story suggests something that is totally out of character for Quakers. They having some similarities to the Anabaptist view, they recognize that the ways of government and military are contradictory to the way of Jesus. Seeing a politician kneeling in prayer was surely not unsettle a Quaker who had any sincerity with his beliefs. So assuming that the story is false, we cannot conclusively tell the purpose of the story, but it strikes me as something that is propaganda from one who wants political involvement and Christianity to be compatible. However, maybe I judge wrongly and the story is true, but if it is true, I ask, should we, like the Quakers, change our beliefs to allow for Christian participation in the military and other government-related jobs that require coercion? Despite the reasons to believe that the story of Washington kneeling in the snow to pray is false, the situation does raise interesting questions about the plausibility of God-honoring righteous individuals participating in the military and other deadly and coercive positions. We are not here to speak about George Washington. We're here to speak about Jesus and what he said to us in Matthew 20. So turn to Matthew chapter 20, verse 20. From our scripture reading, Chad mentioned the continuity of the ideas within the closely positioned stories in Matthew. I think Matthew is probably not chronological. However, it is arranged thematically or by topic. And so we'll be looking at Matthew 20, but we're going to examine the context just a little bit before we get into the verses that we're going to look at most directly. The pinnacle or the summary of the matter is in Matthew 20, 25, and 26. But Jesus called them to himself and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you, but whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant." Now, the surrounding context of Matthew is, I believe, pretty directly leading up to this. If you look at chapter 19, verses 13 through 15, Jesus blesses little children, saying, "For of such is the kingdom of heaven." And there he challenges our ideas of worthiness for entering the kingdom of heaven. In chapter 19, verses 16 through 22, Jesus counsels the rich young ruler to sell what he has and to give to the poor, so he will receive treasures in heaven. Once again, challenging our view of greatness, specifically surrounding economics. In 19:23 through 26, Jesus says that rich people hardly enter the kingdom of heaven. In 19:27 through 30, Jesus says that leaving the family for Jesus' sake is good because the first will be last and the last will be first. He reorients our priorities. In chapter 20, verses 1 through 16, we see the parable of the workers in the vineyard, where Jesus says that those who do the least are paid like those who do the most. Jesus points out that God is not bound by our ideas of fairness. And in chapter 20, verses 17 through 19, Jesus predicts his death and resurrection. Jesus, who is the greatest one ever and the most powerful one ever, will be killed by those who are far lesser than himself. Then in chapter 20, verses 20 through 28, which we will examine more extensively, Jesus redefines greatness. So let's read this and begin at verse 20 and end at verse 28. Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to him with her sons, kneeling down and asking something from him. And he, this is Jesus, and Jesus said to her, "What do you wish?" She said to him, "Grant that these two sons of mine may sit, one on your right hand and the other on the left in your kingdom." But Jesus answered and said, "You do not know what you ask. Are you able to drink the cup that I am about to drink and to be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with?" They said to him, "We are able." So he said to them, "You will indeed drink my cup and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with. But to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it is prepared by my Father." And when the 10 heard it, they were greatly displeased with the two brothers. But Jesus called them to himself and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you, but whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant. And whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many." As he expresses in verses 25 and 26, Jesus makes a sharp contrast between how those in his kingdom operate and how others operate. While the points of difference are many, the contrast in this passage concerns exercising authority over others. Jesus calls his followers to, instead of imposing power over others, to become servants. Look back at verse 21 and 20. Mrs. Zebedee articulates a common human disposition, craving power. In a way, much of human behavior is a demonstration of seeking power. It's why Earth has often been plagued with wars, because people want to have power over others. It's what the political campaigns are about. Hillary wants power and Donald wants power, so they fight about it. It's the way the world works. Herbert Spencer was a 19th century biologist who had some admiration for Charles Darwin, and he commented on Darwin's earlier findings. He's the one who coined the term survival of the fittest, or the tendency towards the most fit being the ones who have the best lives and who survive the longest. Often the survival of the most fit organisms happens at the expense of the least fit organisms. The strong dominate over, power over, and often kill the weak. And though we observe this tendency in animals quite graphically, humans are not exempt. That's how we often choose to get ahead in the world. And perhaps in a way, this is how God intended for us to be. In his summary statement immediately following the creation of humanity, God told Adam and Eve to subdue the earth and to have dominion over the animals. In some ways, God is commanding them, and perhaps by extension us, to have power, to exert influence over, and to show ourselves the rulers. So we might think that it is perfectly natural for James and John to wish for their close association with Jesus, the most powerful one ever. It may be natural for them to use this position to make themselves more powerful and dominant. Is this not just the way that the world works? Probably it is just the way the world works. But one commentator, R.T. French, in his commentary on Matthew, chapter 20, and I have this quote on the screen. He claims that the natural human concern with status and importance is clearly one of the most fundamental instincts which must be unlearned by those who belong to God's kingdom. James and John and their mother had not yet unlearned this. Look at verse 22. You do not know what you ask. Are you able to drink the cup that I'm about to drink and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? Jesus points out that there's much more to his identity than power over others. He is also the one who will die because of the power of others. He speaks of drinking a cup and being baptized. When one is powerful, they are able to do things to others. But Jesus, the most powerful one, applies passive verbs to himself, meaning that he will receive the action of the verbs. Another will cause him to drink, and another will cause him to be baptized. Contrast this with Mrs. Zebedee's request. She asks Jesus to grant, and by doing this, she acknowledges that Jesus is capable of and has the power to act. But by using passive verbs, Jesus informs her that despite his power to act, he will be the one who is acted upon. The normal conventions that we think of surrounding human politics and power do not apply to Jesus' economy and politics. The cup which Jesus speaks of reappears several chapters later in Matthew 26, where Jesus prays that the cup would, I think, uses the word Passover or Passover or something. I think you know where this is, where Jesus is praying. The cup that he speaks of seems to be his crucifixion, torture, and death. And in the context of this passage, Jesus had just reminded his disciples that this was coming. Look at verses 18 and 19 in chapter 20. Where he says, "Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and to the scribes, and they will condemn him to death, and deliver him to the Gentiles to mock and to scourge and to crucify. And the third day he will rise again." This is probably the cup that Jesus is speaking of to his disciples. When the disciples agreed to drink this cup, that is what they were agreeing to. I don't think they understood what this was they were agreeing to. They were still looking for ways to use their relationship with Jesus to find personal power and absolutely not torture and death. In verse 23, where Jesus says, "You will indeed drink my cup and be baptized with the baptism that I'm baptized with," Jesus confronts James and John with the implications of their relationship with him. They will indeed experience an end similar to his own, and not necessarily experience the kind of political power that they were looking for in Jesus' coming kingdom. And Jesus was right. James was killed before long by Herod. We learn about that in Acts chapter 12. And his remains are still today commemorated as relics in Spain, if that's of interest to you. He supposedly preached the gospel there before Herod killed him. John lived much longer than James, but he was still harassed greatly before he died a natural death. And we have reason to believe that he was exiled to Patmos by Domitian before he died. I was interested by this when Jesus told his disciples that they would die and be baptized with the baptism that he was baptized with. So my research about that, I was looking at this book that I recommend to you. It's called The Search for the 12 Apostles by William Stuart McBurney, PhD. It is accessible and entertaining and scholarly and other good things. So I recommend this book to you. There's one section in here that the author brings up that I would like to read to you about John during his old age. He is quoting from Jerome's commentary on Galatians as his source. He says, "At these meetings," talking about church meetings when John was in his old age, John was accustomed to say no more than, "Little children, love one another." After a time, the disciples wearied at always hearing the same words, and they asked, "Master, why do you always say this?" He replied, "It is the Lord's command, and if this alone be done, it is enough." From verse 23, we should not infer that Jesus is insisting that we must also die like John and James. He was speaking directly to them. However, we should remember that our identity with Christ causes us to, in some ways, experience what he experienced. And this certainly does involve taking up a metaphorical cross, and it may mean sharing in the suffering of Christ, as Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians. Zebedee's family seemed to be looking to share power with Jesus, but I don't want to say that that won't be a reality for them. Jesus says that it's not up to him to decide who sits on his right and his left hands. But Paul tells us in 2 Timothy 2:12 that if we endure, we shall also reign with Jesus. And in Revelation 20, verse 4, John says, "I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus, and they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. So somehow and in some way, disciples of Jesus do have the privilege of reigning with Jesus. But the Zebedee's family, as they reign with Christ, they will not reign on their own terms. Only God will decide how this works out for them in his kingdom. And the same applies to us. As we let Jesus reign over our lives, we will let God govern the nature of our reigning. Moving on to verse 24. "And when the 10 heard it, they were greatly displeased with the two brothers." We don't know why they were displeased. Perhaps they were perfectly aware of Jesus' claim that only the Father can determine who will sit on Jesus' right and left. Perhaps they felt disrespected that the two were trying to gain positions of greater honor than the others. And both might be legitimate causes for concern. But we don't know what the disciples were thinking. But Jesus made it plain how we should view the matter. And in verse 25, he forms an important contrast, one that is central to his prescription for us. He assumes that we know about the rulers of the Gentiles. He says, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them." I think we should ask, were Jesus' disciples the rulers of the Gentiles? Absolutely not. We should ask if we are the rulers of the Gentiles, and the answer is the same. We are not the rulers of the Gentiles. So when Jesus tells us what the rulers of the Gentiles do, we can be assured that he is not speaking about us. They, being the rulers of the Gentiles, lord and exercise their authority over their fellow humanity. But Jesus doesn't leave us out in the picture. After he describes what the rulers of the Gentiles do, he speaks to his disciples, and I believe to us as well. He says, "It shall not be so among you." The desire to leverage the powerful people around us to gain power for ourselves, the desire to rule over our brothers and sisters, the desire to subject others to our will, and the desire for others to conform to our expectations for them, this is what shall not be so among us. We have a better king. We are participating in a better political and economic system. The ways and norms of those who have not surrendered to the ultimate king must be rejected by God's people. But Jesus didn't leave us hanging by telling us only what not to do. In verse 26, he tells us a better way to operate. Whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant. And whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave. Remember that we should not lord and exercise our authority over each other. But what we should do instead is become a slave. I think many of you have the King James Version, and in that version, the word minister is used at the end of verse 26, and the word servant is used at the end of verse 27. The word in 26 in Greek is diakonos, and the word in 27 is doulos. These words do not have the same meaning, and Jesus is not being redundant. However, both do indicate a state of being in which one behaves for the good of another rather than for the good of oneself. The investment of time and resources leads to results where the one doing the investing does not receive the primary benefit. This is what we must do instead of looking for positions of dominance. Look at verse 28, where Jesus says, just as the Son of Man did not come to serve, to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. Earlier in the passage, in verse 22, Jesus alludes to the reality of the disciples experiencing things like himself. This thought is continued in verse 28, where he explains why we must serve. We serve like Jesus served. And we serve because Jesus served. Jesus is our perfect model. So his command to serve others is reinforced by his life and death, both of which prioritized the well-being of others. I think most of us are familiar with the passage in Isaiah 52 and 53, where Jesus is called the servant who justifies many. See Isaiah 53:11. He poured out his soul unto death, and he was numbered with the transgressors. He bore the sins of many and made intercession for the transgressors. Jesus' life and his death show a commitment to serving others, healing the sick, and righting what was wrong. So I ask, can we follow his example like he called us to? While I've been saying this, I anticipate that perhaps some of you may have been thinking about other places in the New Testament where some are commanded to have authority or power over others. We might think specifically of 1 Timothy 3:5, where prospective elders should be evaluated based on their history of ruling their household. I am conscious of such statements, and in no way am I attempting to ignore or disregard them. I only have not taken it upon myself to synthesize the plain statements in Matthew 20 with the plain statements elsewhere that might superficially seem contradictory. The claims in the epistles about authority in the church or one's house do not give anybody the license to seek additional positions of power or authority where others may be brought into their realm of coercive influence. I believe there are some applications in this passage for us, some tangible ways that we should respond. When finding applications, we should think proactively. Righteousness is not only about avoiding bad things like coercion. It also includes finding good to do. And so I think the good to do that this passage tells us about is to serve each other and to serve others. And I don't know how to do this well, much less do I know how to tell you to specifically do this. But I will mention several areas where we interact with our world that Matthew 20 seems to address. One involves our view of the government, civil politics. I don't know how it is in other countries, but in America, Christianity and allegiance to America often get syncretized. Many churches prescribe political views and loyalty for their members, often, especially in this area, that means allegiance, respect for the Republican Party, being the Christian Party. But I think we should ask, is it right for Christians to congratulate the successes of an organization that in order to operate depends on anti-Jesus behaviors, such as violence and coercion? The government only functions by demanding that people follow. Boundaries are established with escalating consequences. Many of us have encountered these boundaries and consequences on the lower end of the spectrum, specifically by means of things like fines and warnings and short jail sentences, where the penalties do escalate to long-term prison sentences and even the death penalty. Laws and government are only meaningful in the context of violent coercion to defend the laws, the policies, and the politicians. The whole system is totally opposed to the political method within God's kingdom. So I ask, should we rejoice in anti-Christ-like behavior such as adultery or backstabbing? And I think the answer is no. But I think we also must ask, is it more justifiable to rejoice in anti-Christ-like behavior such as violence and coercion that are integral to the government? And I think the answer, again, is certainly not. While America has had varying degrees of sympathy towards Christianity, probably to a great degree, I think we need to say that America never was actually a Christian nation because of the totally anti-Christ-like methods and policies that allowed it to exist. It's currently not a Christian nation, and it never will be a Christian nation. So as we watch the fireworks, stand or kneel for the anthem, or salute the flag, we should remember that we honor a system opposed to the ethics and economics and politics of Jesus. Or perhaps we should consider simply avoiding these behaviors that honor the political system. I think we should also think about economics when we think about Jesus' commands in Matthew 20. Money gives us the opportunity for power, gives us the opportunity to rule over others, and many rightly view money as power. And if you never heard that, I can give you some citation information. Through various social mechanisms, wealth tends to position people to dominate the economic lives and ultimately the lifestyles and well-being of others. We can make more money for ourselves by virtue of the fact that we already have money. The increased wealth of the few becomes a significant factor in the lives of those who are not well off. So I think we should ask, how will we use our power to treat the oppressed in society? Will we be Christ-like? Will we use our position for service to others? Or will we financially benefit off of others, often specifically targeting the poor? Jesus says that money may be a factor blocking some from God's kingdom. The world says that money is power, and power is greatness. The contrast is absolutely huge. So if we find ourselves possessing economic power, our primary focus must be on serving others with our resources. One's position in the kingdom of the world does not exempt us from the mandate of making service to God and others our primary objective. The one who takes Jesus' call and the way of his kingdom seriously must consistently be a servant to others. The pursuit of personal comfort, pleasure, or dominance over others is contradictory to the way of Jesus, his message, the gospel, and the cross. As a summary, in God's political system and economy, The spectrums are inverted as compared to the earthly political system and economy. We do have existences at the same time in both God's kingdom and the kingdoms of this world, yet our primary allegiance must be to God's kingdom. So when we determine what the good life is, when we choose ethical choices for ourselves, we must use God's measure and God's standard. And that won't always rank us very well in the kingdoms of the world. Jesus commands us to not rule and find greatness. This is opposed to the earthly spectrum, which says that power and dominance are means to greatness. Through his words and his example, Jesus has made a wonderful plan for our lives. So I suggest that we follow him, losing our own greatness in service to others, rejecting coercive dominance, and laying down our lives and resources to promote the welfare of others and God's kingdom.